Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people bring more intelligence to bear on more aspects of that war, understand it better, and communicate more effectively about what's at stake, what we should be doing, what we're not doing, and what will be the consequences of our failure to do what's needed, then our guest for, I'm very pleased to say, a full hour today. Her name is Carolyn Glick. I'm proud of the fact that, among other roles, she is an adjunct senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy. She has been an editorialist, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post for quite some time, and is the author of two very important books, The Israel Solution, A One-State Plan for Peace in the Middle East, and Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad. We've caught up with her in the nation to which she made Aliyah a number of years ago, in which she has served in senior positions in her government, in Israel. Carolyn Glick, it is really a delight to have you back, and thank you so much for giving us generously of your time today.
Great to be on your show again, Frank.
Well, let's see where to begin, Carolyn. There's so much going on in the Middle East and, well, for that matter, elsewhere in the world that you've been keeping an eye on. But I think I'll start with what I kind of think of as some tectonic shifts that have been taking place or are in prospect in the aftermath of the so-called Khashoggi affair, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. He was apparently murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and we're told that the Turks have tapes of this dismembering, apparently, and have begun sharing it with the U.S. government and others, seemingly timed, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, for the return of Congress to the Capitol following the elections last week. Tell us, Carolyn, what you think has happened in this affair and what its implications might be for U.S. policy and interests and the region more generally.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is a push by Turkey and the Turkish regime of Recep Erdogan to push the United States away from Saudi Arabia and towards Turkey. Turkey, of course, is a NATO ally, but it's also an Islamic fascist country under Recep Erdogan, who has used democracy to destroy, not even democracy, he's used popular elections to destroy the basis of the secular Turkish Republic that was established 100 years ago in the aftermath of the fall of the Ottoman Empire. He's made no bones about the fact that his aspiration is to restore the Ottoman Empire and to serve as its sultan. His close ties to the Muslim Brotherhood organization are a means to an end, which is his assertion of control over the Sunni Arab world or the Sunni Muslim world. And one of his main competitors in that, of course, is Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis control the mosques in Mecca and Medina, and they're sort of the seat of Sunni power. Their oil wealth over the past many decades has enabled them to spread their version of Sunni Islam, the Wahhabist Sunni Islam throughout the world. And the difference between the Wahhabist view and the Muslim Brotherhood view of Sunni Islam is that the Wahhabist view is a gradualist position on jihad that enables the maintenance of control of Arab regimes that are tyrannical, like the Saudi regime. And the Muslim Brotherhood view is to pursue jihad by, among other things, overthrowing those regimes. So it's not that there are good guys in the sense that there's somebody who's involved with moderating Islam or Sunni Islam or fighting jihad necessarily in the competition between Erdogan's aspirations to lead the Sunni Muslim world and the Saudi position on where Islam should be and their leadership position there. But this is really an internecine fight within the Sunni Islamic world that's now playing out on the front pages of American newspapers with the Khashoggi affair, because, of course, it isn't as though Recep Erdogan has clean hands with everything related to human rights.
That's for sure. And jihad is jihad, isn't it?
Yes, except for one thing, which is that the Saudis right now, because of the destabilization of the Sunni Arab world since the advent of the misnamed revolutionary movement in the Arab world that was misnamed the Arab Spring in 2010 and 2011, have been fighting a war inside of the Sunni Muslim world against the Muslim Brotherhood, and as a consequence also against jihadist organizations, so that not necessarily because they are good people, but because they view themselves as under threat by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis have sort of joined Israel and other nations in their fight against Sunni jihad, because now they view it as a threat to themselves. So that, you know, the Saudis have actually been a positive force in trying to rein in ISIS, rein in Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and other Sunni Islamic jihadist groups, so that on a relative scale in recent years, while Turkey under Erdogan has been enabling and facilitating Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Hamas and other Sunni jihadist organizations, the Saudis have been fighting them. And therefore, this assault on the Saudis, because they kill people like Khashoggi, just as the Turks do, is really a means to weaken a counter-jihad movement that is being waged or led by the United States now under the Trump administration. And so that's what the problem with the Khashoggi thing is, because you could say, who really cares? You know, we don't have a dog in this fight, but we do have a dog in this fight, because the Saudis, particularly since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was promoted to his position of Crown Prince by his father, you have a leader who's trying to consolidate his power by, among other things, taking down the power centers that were advancing the cause of global jihad in the Saudi ruling family for the past several decades.
Well, there's a lot there to work with. I guess I wanted just to highlight the question, but we'll pick up on the other side of a short break, Carolyn Glick, and that is, who does benefit if the United States winds up retaliating against the Saudis at this moment, as they're being called to do by people on both sides of the political aisle in Washington, D.C. these days, and a lot of others elsewhere around the world, of course? It seems to me it's going to be pretty clearly the Muslim Brotherhood. It's going to be Turkey. It's going to be Qatar. And of course, there's that other country that we haven't spoken of yet, but we will at length with Carolyn Glick as this wonderful hour-long conversation with her progresses, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. That and much, much more with the author of The Israel Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We have the distinct pleasure and high privilege of having Carolyn Glick, one of the most brilliant essayists, analysts, commentators of our time, particularly on matters involving international security and America's interests. She is an American, as you can tell by her accent, originally from Chicago. She is also, these days, of course, an Israeli citizen and has been doing immensely important work there in Israel on behalf of freedom, not just Israel's security, but freedom writ large. And Carolyn, we were talking a little bit about the old Latin expression, cui bono. Who is likely to be the principal beneficiary if, as the Trump administration is insistently being told now, and I suspect more of these demands will be heard as these ghoulish tapes of the dismembering of Jamal Khashoggi surface, that would have real bearing not only on America's vital interests in the Middle East, but also the friends and allies we have there, including, of course, the State of Israel.
It would be a disaster. And it's crazy to say that the guy was just dismembered in the Saudi consulate, and obviously it's hard to imagine that under the circumstances the regime, top members of the regime, weren't directing this, just because of the nature of the Saudi regime and all the other tyrannies that we're dealing with. The thing is that, again, the Saudis have crossed the Rubicon in recent years, and that now they view themselves as threatened by the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have sided very forthrightly with Israel in its wars against Hamas, which is a Muslim Brotherhood terror group, and against Iran. And since Trump took over in the White House from the Obama administration, which opposed Israel and Saudi Arabia and sided with Iran and Turkey and the Muslim Brotherhood against America's traditional allies in both the Sunni Arab world and Israel, the Trump administration has taken the lead in this working relationship that Israel developed with Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Egypt under the Sisi regime against this sort of tripartite hydra of Turkey, Iran, Qatar, with the Muslim Brotherhood as their terror group operating in the region, and of course Hezbollah as the Iranian Foreign Legion, which controls Lebanon. So if you take on Saudi Arabia, what you're acting to do is to try by force through a media campaign, essentially, to take apart this coalition, which is so powerful and so critical from acquiring nuclear weapons, from preventing Iran from asserting hegemonic power in Syria and threatening Jordan and threatening Israel and threatening a host of other American allied nations. So that by standing up, in this case, for the human rights of Khashoggi, who, by the way, was absolutely not some sort of crusader for human rights, the way that the Washington Post and other liberal pro-Muslim Brotherhood media outlets have been presenting him and saying how terrible it is that he was brutally murdered. In the fashion, by the way, that he would have been happy for Jews to be murdered and Americans to be murdered, you know, by standing up for his human rights and saying how terrible the Saudis were for behaving like this, while, of course, turning a blind eye to the fact that the Turks under Erdogan are acting just as despicable a manner towards their own regime dissidents, that is, everybody here is terrible in terms of human rights. What you're actually doing is harming the larger strategic objective that the United States has placed at the center of its Middle East policy and strategy, which is preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons and from asserting hegemonic power in the region in a manner that will endanger all of America's core interests in the region. And endangering, by the way, America's own national security within its own borders. So you're looking at a situation where they're trying to take a crime that was committed by Saudis as a means to undermine the entire alliance structure that the United States relies on for achieving its strategic aims in the Middle East. It's a devastating development. And by the way, I just want to, because we're going to be moving very quickly to Iran, I have to say that sitting here in Israel and looking at what's going on with the Russia probe, you have to see that you see something of the same thing going on with Russia, because the United States, the Trump administration, had very clearly under the first national security advisor that Trump appointed, Michael Flynn, they'd been not hiding the fact that they wanted to pursue a strategy in Syria specifically of trying to seduce Russia away from its alliance with Iran, Hezbollah, Assad, by building on joint interests between the United States and Russia at the expense of Iran. And what the Mueller probe did was force the Trump administration to disavow that policy, which was the proper strategy for trying to deal with Iran and neutralize it as a strategic threat to American interests and allies in the Middle East. And upended that strategy, made it impossible for the Americans to pursue. And instead, they have been pursuing a policy of levying sanctions on Russia, which, by the way, are being breached by the Europeans, and really undermining the entire effectiveness of sanctions as a tool of statecraft, therefore putting into question the effectiveness of even the sanctions policies against Iran. And they're doing this, the Democrats are doing it, the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is involved, and other nefarious groups, because they have an agenda that is to advance and maintain and force the Trump administration to adhere to the Obama administration's foreign policy in relation to Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey on the one hand, and against Israel, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and other American traditional allies, including Egypt, on the other.
Yeah. Carolyn Glick, you have, as usual, brilliantly connected a lot of dots, which we have to see as they map out as a pattern, as a relationship, not just focus on individual ones as though there is no bearing on the rest. And I just, before we turn to Iran, and we will, just tease this out a little bit further. You're describing what would sound to some people as conspiracy theories, and yet there is, at the minimum, evidence of shared interests. And you see people behaving in ways that advance those shared interests, whether it's promoting the Obama administration's agenda or stymieing the Trump administration's agenda or promoting, you know, the Turks or the Muslim Brotherhood, which are more or less one and the same these days, or the Iranians. And the danger is that we in this country all too often do look at these things in isolation. We tend to avert our gaze from the possibility that there are larger strategic plays underway, and in the process make very short-sighted and often even self-destroying decisions on the spur of the moment. I really fear that that's afoot now in connection with the fallout of the Khashoggi business. But could I just ask you, Carolyn, one thing you alluded to that I think it's important for us to help to have everyone understand is the Muslim Brotherhood and the nature of this organization. You mentioned Hamas, which is indeed its Palestinian franchise, a designated terrorist organization. There have been some of us, including the Center for Security Policy, that have long argued that the Muslim Brotherhood itself should be designated as a terrorist organization. Do you agree with that? And is that something that could helpfully clarify in midst all of this, that the alternative to the Saudis is certainly no better and arguably, in the moment at least, considerably worse?
Well, look, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization that one of its immediate goals is to undermine and overthrow regimes that are allied with the United States. And Muslim Brotherhood supporters in Western nations insist that their view is legitimate because they have large constituencies, that is, large numbers of adherents to their totalitarian view of the world inside their own countries. So that, you know, essentially it's saying that, well, because the Nazis won an election or got a plurality of support in the 1933 elections in Germany, they're legitimate. Now, is that true? Well, if you claim that legitimacy is based entirely on numbers, then yes, it's true. The Nazis were a popular party in Germany, and therefore Hitler was a legitimate chancellor, right? Because after all, he had a plurality of support in the 1933 elections, and therefore his government was legitimate. If you look beyond that and you say, well, this is the totalitarian movement that wants to commit genocide of the Jewish people worldwide and then went on to enact that policy,
among other attributes, right, like taking on the world.
Right, and wanted to rule the entire world in the name of the Reich, and went on to, you know, invade and conquer nation after nation in Europe, and would have been well beyond that, and with their Japanese allies were well beyond that in Asia. Then you say, no, actually, it doesn't really matter that they have lots of support among Germans, because that regime in and of itself is a strategic threat to the very notion of human freedom, not to mention the notion of human life. And so you have to defeat it, even if it is popularly elected. And it's the same thing with the Muslim Brotherhood. Their goal is the totalitarian goal of establishing a world caliphate, which is a jihadist empire that's supposed to rule the entire world. And one of their immediate goals is to overthrow all of the Arab and other regimes that have been keeping them at bay through repression and other means. And so if you say, well, then you're anti-democratic, if you don't accept the Muslim Brotherhood, then you can say, well, you have to define what democracy means. If democracy means one man, one vote, one time, then yes, then I don't agree that that's democracy. I agree that that is popular elections, but that's not the same as a regime that one can peacefully coexist with.
Carolyn Glick is our guest. She is a columnist for Breitbart and the Jerusalem Post. We will be returning with much more with Carolyn Glick right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
The fabulous Carolyn Glick is in the house virtually. We've caught up with her in Jerusalem. She is an extraordinary resource for all of us who love freedom, but most especially those who understand what's at stake for the free world, most immediately from developments in the Middle East. And Carolyn, we've been talking mostly about the Sunni side of the Middle East complex interactions, tectonic shifts, dynamics, whatever you want to call them. Let's turn to the Shia, the Iranian Republic, as it's known, a totalitarian, despotic theocracy ruled or misruled, if you will, by Shia clerics now for nearly 40 years, is very much on the mind, of course, of Israel. And I think now very much on the mind of the Trump administration as well, as it should be on all of our minds because of the threat that it poses. Talk us through a little bit, as you see it, both from Jerusalem, but also, you know, as a woman with a 30,000-foot view of these things, why should Americans be concerned about what's going on in Iran and what Donald Trump has been trying to do of late by tearing up the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and reimposing sanctions there?
Look, the Iran regime has been in a state of war with the United States since it was established. And one of the first things that it did was it took over the U.S. embassy and it held U.S. diplomats hostage for 444 days. And this was an act not only, obviously, of war against the United States, but it was an act of war against the very international system upon which America has based its power, the concept of a nation state, the concept of international relations, of diplomatic immunity, of all sorts of things that are the basis of the way that Americans view the world and that it has based its power on. So on a just sort of an existential, foundational level, the existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran is a threat to the United States, and it's a threat that has manifested itself. It's a bullet that has been shot against the United States on numerous occasions. You know, last month, we marked the 35th anniversary of the Marine Barracks bombing, which was an Iranian operation. That was the single largest terrorist attack committed against the United States of America on foreign soil. Until 9/11, 243 U.S. Marines were killed that day. And that was a bombing that was carried out by the forerunner of Hezbollah, and it was directed by Iran. So this is a regime that has been at war with the United States since it was established. So just on the basis of that, it's clear that it's a threat. It's also a threat to the United States because it's developing nuclear weapons. It has ballistic missiles. It's continuing to develop its ballistic missile technology. It's rich. It has vast natural gas and oil resources that it exports to, and it uses the money that it receives from those exports, just forgetting for a second what Obama did for this regime, to finance its war. And, you know, just look at the sad and sorry state of the Iranian society to understand what the regime's priorities are. You know, people, they've had chronic unemployment of over 25% for over a decade. And they have massive repression at home, massive torture, political prisoners, executions every year, because that's not what they're about. They're not about advancing the interests of the Iranian people. They're about advancing the interests of their Islamic theocracy and their quest for Islamic domination of the world. And again, this is something that's obviously antithetical to America's most basic national security interests. So these are the reasons, mainly, that the United States in and of itself is under threat by Iran, and that Americans should recognize this and view Iran as its enemy, because it is. It has been, and it will continue to be. That's their goal, that's their action, and that's their path. So long as there's just the regime, the Iranian regime views itself in a state of war with the United States and against everything that America cares about and represents.
Yeah. So, Carolyn Glick, let me just try to tease this out a little bit. You spoke earlier about Turkey under Recep Tayyip Erdogan seeking to reestablish the Ottoman Empire. In fact, I believe he's made no secret of his ambition to be the next caliph of a global Sunni caliphate. You have, on the other hand, the Ayatollahs who seek a similar kind of triumph of Sharia under Shiite rule globally. And yet you mentioned in the previous segment that the Turks and the Iranians are aligned. They're making common cause against the Saudis and against us, for that matter. Even the Muslim Brotherhood is working with these Shiites. And you know, it has been a matter of canon in American policy circles, intelligence circles, and the like, that the Shia and the Sunni hate each other. They couldn't possibly get along. How could it both be that they have these exclusive ambitions to rule in the version of Islam that they practice, and yet they seem perfectly prepared to make common cause, including, by the way, on 9/11, the Sunnis of Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, you know, how was the United States able to cooperate with Stalin and the Soviet Union to fight their common foe of Nazi Germany during World War II? Because the most immediate threat was Germany, and therefore the United States and the Soviets were willing to, you know, put aside their differences, which were existential, as the Cold War, which followed World War II, made clear. They were able to bury the hatchet for 6 years or 4 years in order to defeat a common foe, which was Nazi Germany. They defeated that foe, and then they proceeded to go to war against one another.
Cold War, albeit.
Right. And so the United States and the Soviet Union were willing to do this. When, you know, then obviously there's no reason to assume that the Iranians and the Sunnis shouldn't be able to do this. Of course they're able to do this. This has sort of been the pattern of human operations since the dawn of history. And yet we think that for some reason, because it's convenient for analysis purposes, to pretend that this doesn't happen with other people. Of course it happens with the Sunnis and the Shiites. Of course they're operating in conjunction with one another to defeat foes that they consider to be more acute and more immediate.
Yeah. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend operates on their side. Unfortunately, the enemy of my enemy is still on my enemy, in our case, it seems, in these instances.
What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And in our view, you know, and the problem is that because of the media atmosphere in the West, which inundates us with information to the point where it's hard to understand what we're looking at because we have so much of it, we can't always see the forest for the trees. So when they show us stories after stories about the horrible way that Khashoggi was murdered and decapitated or dismembered or whatever in the Saudi embassy or the Saudi consulate in Turkey, we can't remember, first of all, that the source of all of this information is Turkey. All of this information is coming from Turkey. Erdogan has literally hundreds of Turkish journalists in jail, subjected to torture and extrajudicial executions and all the rest of it. And of course, we're not looking at that. We're looking at what he wants us to see.
The shiny dangling object.
Exactly. And so we're all following the shiny object, forgetting that the person who's giving us this information is a murderer who doesn't have U.S. best interests at heart.
Well, and you also, of course, have among the other promoters of all of this, the Iranians. And as you've said repeatedly, Carolyn, these are guys who have blood on their hands as well, journalists among many, many, many others, including Americans. Carolyn, let me just ask you, as you look at all of this, there clearly is an awful lot that suggests the most important issues with respect to the Middle East do not involve the Palestinians. And yet there seems to be, as perennially is the case in Washington, a preoccupation with some sort of peace being forged between Israel and the Palestinians. The president has been telegraphing for some time, as you know, that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has come up with a plan for Middle East peace. And the president has even intimated that because he has such a good relationship with Bibi Netanyahu, among other things, based upon the quite courageous, quite commendable decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, that he's got chits that he's going to cash in to get Israel to go along with the Kushner peace plan, which is yet to be unveiled. But just walk us through, whether it's any more advisable today, against the backdrop you've just given us, to be pursuing some sort of deal with the Palestinians, and if so, whether the kinds of deal that we're likely to get is another set of concessions by Israel to the Palestinians to try to jolly them into making some kind of durable peace with Israel is still a fool's errand.
Well, I mean, the truth is that I don't know whether the Trump administration's fully understood this or not, but the whole Palestinian issue is a made-up issue. It's an issue that's been used over the past many, many decades to hide the fact that Israel is the United States' most important and stable ally in the Middle East. Because what the Palestinian conflict with Israel is about is it's about trying to push Israel down and delegitimize it from a moral perspective. And much the way, by the way, that the Khashoggi affair is trying to destroy the basis of the U.S. alliance with the Saudi Arabians by saying that they're immoral. Now, in the Saudi case, they are immoral. They're a bunch of murderers. Yeah. So what else is new? Who in the Islamic world is not like that? There's not one Islamic regime in the world that doesn't do these sorts of things. They all engage in this unacceptable behavior from a Western perspective. Luckily for us, we don't live in those societies. If we did, we would be subjected to the same rules that have governed those societies forever. And if somebody wants to think about fixing it, just remember what happened to the United States and Iraq, because that was exactly the goal of the Iraqi war, and it failed completely.
It's also a very cautionary note about the advisability of allowing these people to export this, I think of it as Sharia supremacism, to our countries, needless to say. It can only end badly, as they say. Carolyn, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Jordan and also about America. We'll be right back with more with Carolyn Glick, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our final installment of this extraordinarily interesting, thought-provoking, and informative conversation with one of the great minds of our time, Carolyn Glick. She has distinguished herself in many roles, including as an aide to Benjamin Netanyahu earlier in his career in the so-called peace process. She knows whereof she speaks when she talks about it as a shiny dangling object. She has also been an extraordinarily accomplished author and essayist on matters involving both the security of the Middle East and the interests of the United States, as well as the broader free world and, of course, her native Israel. Carolyn Glick, I did want to touch on something. You mentioned Jordan in passing there just before the end of the last segment. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with King Abdullah having unilaterally and without notice abrogated, I guess, arrangements that had been fashioned during the peace negotiations and treaty between Israel and Jordan. And what are the implications of what he's done?
But I mean, in a way, Abdallah just abrogated two annexes of the deal that enabled Israel to lease land from Jordan for 25 years. This is land that sovereign claims were made by both sides. Israel agreed to sideline its own sovereign claims in the interest of peace. And the deal was that Israel would accept Jordanian sovereignty claims to the areas. In exchange, Jordan would lease the lands that are on the border, both in the north and the south of both countries, in long-term leases to Israeli farmers who have been farming the lands for over 100 years. So he just announced that he wasn't going to extend the lease for an additional 25 years now that the initial lease is about to come up next year. And really what this shows is twofold. One, it shows that Abdallah himself is exceedingly weak, and he's weak because he's lost the support not only of the Palestinian majority in Jordan. Jordan has two-thirds ethnic Palestinian, which is why when people say Jordan is Palestine, they're correct. At least it's Palestinian. And the other thing is, it shows that there's only limited purpose to any of these peace deals, because Israel pays in real coinage in order to receive a piece of paper where Arab regimes that have no popular support say that they're at peace with Israel. Okay, Israel and the Hashemite kingdom, much like Israel today and the House of Saud, had an effective alliance with one another since the early 1970s, when Israel saved the Hashemite kingdom from being overthrown by a joint force of the PLO and the Syrian regime, which was about to invade. And since then, Israel and the Jordanians were in an alliance. It was under the table. It wasn't public, but everybody sort of knew about it. It was an open secret. The minute that we made peace with them, then suddenly the regime, which is not popular and is not strong and is not powerful, suddenly had to constantly defend itself and its decision to have a formal peace with Israel towards its own restive population, which each time that they have economic travails or social issues turns on the regime because of the deal with Israel. Now, the regime did have 25 years to try to diminish some of the wall-to-wall hatred for Jews in Jordanian society. It did nothing to stem that hatred. I mean, according to a Pew poll, 100% of Jordanians hate Jews. Just imagine. And as a consequence, every time when he goes against Israel, when Abdallah attacks Israel, which he does all the time, really, from a diplomatic perspective, although military people will tell you that it's not at all the case from a military perspective, it's because he's facing massive demonstrations against his regime's call for his overthrow that have passed from the Palestinians and the Muslim Brotherhood to the Bedouin tribes that form the backbone of the regime. So this is a real problem. Israel doesn't have a better option, Jordan, than the Hashemites, and therefore it's just going to bite this bullet like it's bit all of them. But we have to bear in mind that he is a very slim reed, and the concept of solving the problems of the region by signing a formal peace is absolutely ridiculous, and it shouldn't be anywhere in the minds of Western policymakers when they're trying to figure out how to stabilize the region. Yeah.
And you know, it also, it seems to me, ought to be the case that we treat the argument that we cannot designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization because it is part of the king's government in Jordan. We have to recognize that that's not a basis for dealing with our vital interests clearly and effectively either. Carolyn, I did want to, speaking of being clear, turn to one last topic with you, because you've written recently about it at Breitbart, I believe, and that is what America chose in this most recent election. Specifically, Carolyn, as a former American who knows this country intimately, knows its politics very well, what you make of what is happening to the Democratic Party at the moment with respect to anti-Semitism, for heaven's sakes, let alone, you know, a hostility towards the state of Israel?
Look, I mean, I think it's important to understand that anti-Zionism, that is hatred of Israel, rejection of Israel's right to exist, is a form of anti-Semitism. It's, in fact, the most potent and dangerous form of anti-Semitism today, because it's used as a basis for attacking Jews on a daily basis, not only in Israel, but throughout the world. And so we ignore this because we want to believe that this is just a political fight and it's not. And that's one of the things that's important, because we see the rise of anti-Semites who call themselves anti-Zionists in the Democratic Party. And we see that on the other side, there's people who aren't anti-Semites in the Democratic Party, think that the way to deal with this is to agree with them, that this is just about policy towards Israel and it's not about hatred of Jews. And so when you don't deal with a cancer like anti-Semitism, guess what? It metastasizes and spreads throughout the body. And that's what's been happening in the Democratic Party. And we've been seeing it, you know, over the past decade. And it came out very strongly in the primaries before, not the general elections, but the summer primaries for the Democratic candidacy for the Congress, where you saw a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of support, particularly in deep blue districts that are uncontested by Republicans, for Democratic candidates who are openly anti-Semitic, that is, anti-Zionist, who believe that Israel has the right to exist, and Jews who support Israel are in and of themselves illegitimate as political actors in the United States or in France or anywhere else in the world, because Zionism, that is the right of the Jews to have self-determination and freedom in their land, is evil. And so, you know, this is something that we're seeing play out in the Democratic Party now for many years. I would argue since the 2006 Democratic primary for Connecticut Senator, where Joseph Lieberman, the longtime senator, was defeated by a businessman named Ned Lamont, who ran an openly anti-Semitic campaign against Lieberman.
Lieberman went on to beat him, of course, as an independent.
But as an independent, and he got and he won as a result of Republican votes. So you have a situation where, you know, anti-Semitic forces in the Democratic Party are rising. You see it on the grassroots with people like Keith Ellison,
the new attorney general elect of Minnesota, no less. Yeah, chilling thought, a Sharia supremacist in that role. And Carolyn, I did want to just hit one other thing quickly. We've only got about a minute and a half, but talk about what you call Jewry's, American Jewry's false prophets. This is a very powerful piece in the Jerusalem Post, in which you went after, among others, Franklin Foer. Talk about him.
Look, I mean, you have a situation where, for various reasons, a leading voices in the American Jewish community, and particularly pundits, are pretending, again, because they don't want to deal with the political implications, they're pretending that the Democrats' embrace of anti-Zionists is not a turn towards anti-Semitism. And they want to pretend that anti-Zionism is a political dispute between Israelis or between various views of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, when it's not. And so they want to do this because they want to remain Democrats, and they want to do it because they want to be anti-Trump for political and ideological reasons. And so they're ignoring the cancer in the Democratic Party and pretending it away in order to then accuse the Republicans of being anti-Semitic, when in fact the opposite is the case.
So much more to talk with you about, Carolyn, but we're not going to be able to do it today. I'm so grateful to you for this full hour of conversation. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. We value so much what you do at Breitbart and the Jerusalem Post, as well as your two terrific books, The Israel Solution and Shackled Warrior. Check them out, folks. Carolyn, come back to us again, as I say, soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.